This program is brought to you by Cabinet, a nonprofit arts organization based in Brooklyn, New York. Cabinet depends on your support to continue our activities. For more information, visit us online at cabinetmagazine.org.
The following recording is of Revisiting Extinct Sounds, a panel with artist Sari Carroll and media scholar Jonathan Stern, moderated by curator Leah Abir. The event was organized by artists and took place on September 30th, 2011.
Thanks for joining us. This event, in which we will revisit extinct sounds and early sound devices through the prisms of cultural history and artistic practice, is organized as part of my curatorial fellowship at ARTIS, which is a nonprofit organization that supports and promotes contemporary visual artists from Israel internationally. Founded in 2001, ARTIS is based in New York with activities in Tel Aviv and Los Angeles. It advances opportunities for cultural understanding and dialogue through artistic commissions, talks and events, professional development, and research initiatives for artists and art professionals. Project-specific grants and an online resource, artiscontemporary.org. I'm grateful to Yael, Persis and Chen from ARTIS who have made this event possible. And I would also like to thank Cabinet, this is an awesome space, and Sinana Jaffe in particular for hosting and facilitating it. So I'm gonna have a seat. Okay. So the process leading to this evening started with a studio visit that I made to Sari Carroll's studio. A multidisciplinary artist based in New York, Sari's work explores and plays with the visual and auditory, as well as with representations of the natural and the designed. It was during this visit that I first heard the intriguing story behind what was then, and maybe still is, a work in progress called Semaphore Island. It took us a little bit of research, not a lot of research, from the moment we thought this might also be interesting to other people but us, to the point where we contacted Jonathan Stern, a writer and scholar who teaches at McGill University's Department of Art History and Communication and its Philosophy of Science program. A researcher of sound, culture, and the history and philosophy of technology, Jonathan is the author of the influential book The Audible Past, Cultural Origins of Sound Reproduction, very recommended. And his writing has been published in numerous publications worldwide. Jonathan was generous enough to respond positively to our unexpected invitation, and I'm grateful to him for taking part in this dialogue. We all imagine this evening to be first and foremost an entry into artistic process. So we would like to start by hearing Sari Carroll tell the story of Semaphore Island.
Hi, thank you all for coming. I want to thank Artiz and Leah for organizing this event and Cabinet for hosting, and thank you, Jonathan, for descending into New York especially for our event. I'm going to tell you a little bit about the background and then the process of the work. So this project started with a few different interests that gradually got funneled into this one place. I have been an avid listener and collector of field recordings of birds, and these recordings have come to constitute a motif that runs throughout the soundtracks of my video works. I have also used field recordings of birds in an outdoor sculpture and sound piece I've done a few years back, in which natural and synthetic sounds were woven into a soundtrack that interacted with large abstract form, a kind of visual and sonic drawing in space. I was interested in this overlap of extinct birds that we actually have a recording of, or ones that are on their way to disappearance. This puts them in the sphere of our lives and our time, and a species literally being erased in a sound recording, this vivid document or imprint left in its place. I was looking for ways to process, play with, and represent these sounds, and when I stumbled upon the phonoautograph during some meandering research into early sound recording experiment and completely captured my imagination. This obscure machine in my mind gone extinct that takes sound and turns it into an image. This was perfect, both as a mechanism and a metaphor. It is this place where image and sound, whose relationship often is just assumed and accepted, gets redefined, where sound and image reassess and size up each other, something dynamic, fluid, and not necessarily resolved. So I started looking into it more. And the few of these machines I could find, none of them work. Finally, I located Jean-Paul Agnard, a collector and early sound recording enthusiast in Canada, and we started emailing and figuring out how to do this. In the end, I flew over there to this out-of-the-way tiny town that incidentally is also a Christian pilgrimage destination. They have a cathedral there that cures the disabled and the sick, apparently. So we drive around and finally find this cluttered museum on a drab, ordinary residential street behind a pilgrimage site, which in itself was quite surreal. As you can see in the video we will play in a minute, this was an incredible space and collection. We piled a bunch of speakers into this antique device and started to figure out how to capture the sound of each bird. The video shows a small cluster of successful rounds, but there was a lot of trial and error, and at some point there was a mini crisis when the membrane seemed to have gotten damaged from being overburdened by the vibrations. The stylus in this case is a boar bristle that is flexible enough to pass on the sound legibly to a piece of paper. The paper has been smoked over an oil lamp, so it is covered with soot. The bristle draws marks in the soot and later gets fixed in alcohol. So we're going to see a little clip of the process. You'll get a better idea of it.
We start with this one.
Okay.
Okay. So when you are ready, you put it on and I stop.
Okay, hold on, let me just.
Beginning is very.
That's amazing. That's excellent.
Such recording. Never.
The voices of the wild.
Wow. Incroyable. And if you look, they are all the same, man. Huh?
Wow.
Excellent.
Ah, poof. You have some more like that? If it is all like that.
You can't hear? It's really moving.
If you are here, you just say express me.
True.
Good. First one.
Very nice.
And the second one, somewhere. Look.
It's great.
If the museum saw me doing that, it would kill me. Here we are. And if you look at the process of the alcohol. It's instantaneous. As soon as you put it inside, it's fixed. Look at that. See that?
So according to Agnard, the trickiest part was to find a stylus that works. That is the thing that draws on the paper. There are no technical drawings of this machine completely assembled, and for 10 years, he tried different methods until he figured out how to make it work. Agnard was telling us these machines were obscure and misunderstood for a long time, to the point that once he went to see an exhibition in a university, and the cone and the drum were actually exhibited in two different rooms. There was no realization that these are two parts of the same machine. So I'm going to show you now some of the images that we made during our recording session. This is still a project in progress, and the images are I'm still working on their final incarnation and developing the work, playing around with it, figuring out what their visual life is going to be like. There's something fascinating to me about these drawings or imprints, their relationship to early photography, the direct engagement with the material, and the relationship of early photography to death. The whole materiality of it was a surprise to me. When you think this all originated in vibrations and sound and is caught or captured or plasticized into such a compelling yet very abstract and essentialized image. So this is the Hawaiian crow, which is now extinct in the wild. The next one is the ivory-billed woodpecker, now is extinct. Next one is a Guam flycatcher, extinct. Next one is a Kauai uh-oh, extinct. And we actually have a bit of a soundtrack of this one, just so you get a feel for it. And you can hear the kwai-au calling out in the far, in the ambient sound of the forest, and there is no other bird to answer its call. The next one is the dusky seaside sparrow, extinct. The next one, nightingale reed warbler, critically endangered. Followed by the black stilt, critically endangered. And finally here, the Bachman's warbler, extinct. The second part of this piece, which is basically going to be a sound and print installation, is a soundtrack that I'm working with composer Ryan Brown. And it incorporates the extinct bird sounds that I've collected with other bird calls and a whole sonic environment that is in dialogue with the visual images. We're going to play you now a short clip of what this is going to sound like. It's still in progress again. Thank you. So this is the sonic part of the installation. Great, thank you.
Thank you. Jonathan, maybe you can tell us a little bit more about the phonautograph, about its invention, its functions. Thank you.
All right, well, I'll start by turning this thing on. So I'll begin by thanking Leia and Sari, Persis, Chen, everyone at Cabinet and Artists for making this happen, and of course all of you for coming out and enduring the free beer. So what the hell is a phonautograph and why should you care? To answer that question, I want to start with a different device. This is Thomas Edison's phonograph, roughly an 1899 version. I became really interested in a simple question, which was, why were sound reproduction technologies, the ones that we have today that surround us, why were they invented when they were? If you look at the parts of that phonograph, although it was invented in 1877, it could have been invented decades or maybe even centuries before. The technology wasn't anything new. The way a phonograph works is you see there's that cylinder there, that's a recording surface. And so if you wanted to record something, you would lean over, you'd speak into the horn, you'd turn the crank, and it would vibrate a diaphragm with a stylus attached to it, much like the phonautograph you just saw in Sari's video. And it would make grooves, first in tin foil and later on a wax cylinder. And then you'd simply reverse the process to play it back. Now, what interested me in this, or what I came to believe, was that the reason it was invented when it was, along with the telephone and radio soon thereafter, was because it represented a change in thinking about sound in the 19th century. And so I went looking for ancestors. And it wasn't really hard because, of course, new technologies leave huge paper trails, and the phonautograph's a prominent player in prior art sections of early patents for telephones and phonographs and radios. So here we have a phonautograph. It was invented by a man named, pardon my French, even though I live in Montreal, Edouard Léon Scott de Martinville. We'll call him Leon Scott because we're in America. Invented in 1857 in Paris, and he conceived the device as a sound writer. Now, it is itself a sort of minor figure in the history of technology. If it's extinct, its species didn't have a very long and prosperous life before that extinction. But basically what he conceived it as was as an automatic sound writer, and specifically voice, right? Phone, voice, auto, automatic, graph, writer. And so what the phonautograph did was it was designed to be a sort of automatic stenographer of the voice. You'd speak into it, you'd turn the crank, and it would make these squiggly lines on a piece of paper, as you saw. Now, the phonautograph was interesting because it was part of a sort of whole set of devices in the 19th century that tried to graph natural processes that happened in the world. In other words, to turn them into, I'll get to that thing in a second, that turned them into viewable images, because it was part of this whole epistemology that if you could see it, you could better understand it. But it also represents a kind of shift in the way people were thinking about sound technologies. If in 1820 or 1780 you had the dream of like reproducing the sound of a speaking voice, or the sound of a violin being played or a drum being beaten, you would build a device that reproduced the mechanism by which those things happened. So if you wanted to reproduce the playing of a violin, you would build a violin playing automaton. If you wanted to reproduce the voice of a speaking person, you would build something with lips, a tongue, a larynx, a mouth, and that's something that could blow air through it. That's what you would do. But the phonautograph did something different. It imitated the process of the middle ear. It basically imitated the process of hearing. And so instead of trying to reproduce the cause of a sound, it tried to reproduce the effect of a sound. And that basic process is what we still have here today. I mean, this very room follows the same process. This microphone vibrates sympathetically in relationship to what my voice is saying, and those speakers do as well, and the sound arrives at your ears. Now, this process of turning sound into other stuff and then turning other stuff back into sound has a technical name, which is transduction, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a minute. But the phonautograph was super interesting to both Thomas Edison and Alexander Graham Bell. Bell in particular got really involved with it. He was, among other things, a elocutionist and a teacher of deaf children, and he subscribed to a school of thought called oralism, which was you try to train deaf people to speak like the hearing and effectively to pass as hearing people. Today he's pretty reviled in deaf cultural history for that reason. So Bell's goal was, in using the phonautograph, if it automatically registers speech, he imagined he would speak into it, he would turn the crank, it would produce these squiggly lines. Then his pupil, usually a deaf child, would also speak into it and turn the crank, and they would modulate their voice until their squiggly lines matched his, and as a result, you would have a deaf person speaking like a hearing person. Now, in point of fact, it was not, it didn't work very well. It wasn't sensitive enough. And so the first thing Bell said is, well, we need a better diaphragm than what Scott's phonautograph gives us. And so he went looking for one, and he talked to his friend Clarence Blake, an otologist at Harvard University. And Blake said, well, you know, if you're trying to imitate the ear, why don't we just get an ear? And so what you have there is the ear phonautograph, which has a human ear on it. Now, you're looking at the ear from the inside of the head out, right? So you're looking at the skull and the small bones, and they in case you wonder like how they kept it lubricated, it was a solution of 50% glycerin, 50% water. Don't try this at home. And I guess the other thing is, so it's this bizarre and ghastly machine that would produce was supposed to produce a much more sensitive and articulate image that would help him in his pursuit of teaching deaf children. But it still didn't really work out. In later speeches, Bell would say the thing this machine did do was give him the idea for the telephone, because he said, you know, a very small and fine diaphragm could actually have tremendous effect upon much bigger parts and thereby reproduce sound. One other earphone autograph story, he took it on vacation in Scotland, but rumors started spreading around, so he said, oh no, it's a dog's ear, it's not a person's ear. All right, so this device shows up in the patent histories. So a phonautograph made phonautograms, and Scott was militant about that the important thing was writing. He had these fantasies that it would produce a kind of universal language, sort of automatic stenography that anybody could read, which of course ignores the fact that French, for instance, produces different squiggly lines than English. And he also thought that the writing was sort of its highest calling. So he actually derided Edison's phonograph when it was invented, saying his device merely reproduces sound, mine writes it. All right, well, I already said a little bit about transduction. It is, in physics, it's simply the process whereby energy is transformed from one form to another. And in media, transduction happens when machines change a signal from one form to another. right? So the phonograph needle transduces vibrations in the air into patterns in an electrical signal. A digital camera transduces patterns of light into arrangements of bits. A laser printer transduces a data stream several times as it becomes print on the page. That's what I'll say about transduction. It is really a finer tool for thinking about the history of media, I think, than terms like mediation or reproduction or representation, because it defines a specific relationship between sort of events in the world and what technologies do and their place in them. So, that said, our phonautograph here, the story's not over, although it was quickly abandoned as a experimental tool in physics and science, and that's why there aren't many working in the world today. Interest around it sprung up again in 2008 when a group of researchers and historians called First Sounds played back a phonautograph recording. So you could say from 1860 to 2008, that is the world's single longest transduction. Now, this was no small feat. The group's 2008 playback of a vocal rendition of Eau Claire de la Lune, which we'll hear in a minute, was accomplished using technology inspired by new preservation practices actually for phonograph cylinders. Because some cylinders are close to 100 years old, if you want to play them back, putting a nice, you know, like metal needle on them is not such a good idea. And so what people at the Library of Congress and elsewhere do when they want to preserve an old cylinder is they have a laser stylus, and then the computer reads it and produces a sound file. The First Sounds people rightly figured that they could apply this process to phonautograms as well, so that the laser would trace the squiggly lines on the phonautogram, and it would then play them back. Now, this is epistemologically, this is kind of an interesting case, right? Because the phonautograms were never meant to be heard. And Scott says over and over, right, I'm building a sound writer. These are not to be listened to. These are to be viewed. So to call it playback is, it's an interesting question whether it is playback or not. But the result is you hear something like a recording from 1860. Now, there's a lot of reconstruction that goes into this as well. And the first example we're going to play for you actually shows the reconstruction. So what you've got is like the equivalent of a tuning fork pitch, and you'll hear it a few times. And what you're hearing is the First Sounds people doing more and more reconstruction to get the pitch out of the recording. So let's play it once, and then I'll talk about what's happening there. The first thing I have to say is every time I hear it, I want to put like a really heavy break beat right under it. Yeah, boom, ka, boom, 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 ka. Yeah. So, I mean, you can actually hear the work of reconstruction, right? So these things are very, like you saw how slow he was in the video, he was cranking the phonautograph. These are very low resolution recordings to begin with. And although the patent deposits, and that's the source the First Sounds people were using, or the Scott's French patent office deposits, they give some information like what's on it. They don't tell you how fast it was recorded or what the original pitch was in some cases, and so you sort of have to guess. So what they're doing in each case is applying judgments, basically, and using more and more processing inside the computer to get closer and closer to what he said it was. So again, we'll listen to that recording, and then I'll show you another way that this plays out with two more. Thank you. Right. So what they're doing is they're taking more and more of the noise, which was actually part of the recording, out of the recording. And so it's getting closer and closer to what you think the original tone might have been. But at the same time, it's getting further and further away from what's actually in the recording. Now, the next two are interesting because they're actually the same recording, but two different reconstructions. They're both performances of Au Clair de la Lune, but they didn't know how fast the crank was turned, and they didn't know who sang it. Was it a man? Was it a woman? What pitch was it sung at? What speed was it sung at? They don't know. And so they did one reconstruction, which they thought was accurate, until they did some more and said, well, wait, all these others appear to have been made by a man, so let's pitch shift this down a little bit. So, you know, retroactively, this might be the world's first auto-tuning. So let's hear the two versions. And the other evidence that it might, that the second one might be more quote unquote accurate, is that, you know, the phonautograph's not very sensitive. So you saw Sari like shoving the speakers into the horn. So probably to get any decent recording, you got to put your face right in there and belt it out. And so that sort of slow, deliberate delivery probably yielded a better phonautogram than the sort of faster, warblier version. So first, sound's intervention then was to ignore Scott's intent and instead consciously and deliberately reconstruct the recordings as if they had been made for playback. Now, it's a cliche of the history of technology that inventors' intentions have a way of not working out, and that whatever purpose or intention is built into a technology can change over time. Right, the usual story is one of invention, innovation, engagement with users, reconstruction ad infinitum, as technologies achieve moments of temporary closure, only to be opened again and reconfigured from a new unexpected angle. The phonautograph story, however, is a little different. First sound's accomplishment of sounding a phonautogram shows an even greater degree of plasticity of sound as data that can move across sensory registers. At the same time, it also shows the degree to which the same data can move across different registers. So this is perhaps the greatest irony of the device, is that it failed as a sound writer, but with a good deal of help from computers and from our very ears, it ended up being involved both in the invention of sound reproduction technologies as we know them today and in the historical reconstruction of sound from 1860. Thank you.
So now we're going to have a small discussion. I've prepared a few questions. Let's see how many we can get in. And then we're going to open up to your questions. So be prepared. So Jonathan and Sari, one of the most interesting issues for me, in the work of both of you is that of extinction and preservation. Jonathan, in one of your essays dealing with the preservation of digital sound, you describe it very vividly, the process that cultural products go through before they become historical document, that is, before they are given the honor of being worthy of preservation. That process, as you describe it, entails a great deal of forgetting. Can you describe it for us, and especially your claim that this process is actually intensified by the current digitalization, and I quote you, if I may. If early recordings were destined to become lost recordings, digital recordings move in the same direction, but they do so more quickly and more fitfully. Sorry.
Okay, Yes. So, what I was trying to say there is that, well, there's a few things. So first of all, we often forget that early sound recordings were primarily disposable commodities. I mean, there was this whole genre of early recording messages to future generations, which is itself sort of this bizarre phenomenon. But they were really designed as disposable popular cultural commodities, not that different sort of ontologically from postcards or paperback books or things like that. So most early recordings weren't, you know, held by their owners as sacred objects. They were thrown out. And this throwing out, as many authors have argued, is actually a really important part of producing rarity and then rendering things able to be preserved, right? So, I mean, we can see it more recently with things like floppy disks, which were, you know, disposable and ridiculous. But now if you had a device that actually, you know, ran a floppy disk system and you have some old artwork on it, it becomes this huge sort of preservation exercise because of its rarity, which is in turn a direct result of its disposability, right? So there's a whole lot of you know, obsolescence being the result of a certain mode of consumer culture and also a certain mode of technological design. Now, why digital files? Why does this happen faster with digital files? Well, it has to do with their commodity form, or in some cases, lack thereof. You know, you have very quick turnover in operating systems, in software, and in sort of digital protocols. And so things that worked in earlier iterations don't work so well. And I mean, this is less the case in more recent years with audio formats in general. Like, there's better backward compatibility even with, like, you know, cheesy real media files from the 1990s and earlier. But at the same time, you know, there were, you know, devices that no longer exist or are no longer in wide circulation. And individual recordings and files, as they proliferate, right, there are more recordings in circulation now than at any other time in human history, renders the whole enterprise incredibly banal. And so, you know, what happens when, you know, some esoteric band's website goes down because they were part of the original MP3.com? I mean, if you could find the MP3s, they would be, they could be played back. But since they may not have even existed on a compact disc, you know, those hard drives are long since gone, right? So as the media themselves become more disposable and more subject to that same consumerist logic, it becomes harder and harder to preserve large swaths of things. But the flip side of that is you can't preserve everything, and if you did, you couldn't write history because there would be no process of selection, and it would be completely overwhelming. It would be, you know, back to the Borges map territory problem.
And Sari, I know your work touches upon extinction and preservation in at least two important ways. The voices of extinct birds reappearing once in this rich soundtrack that we just heard, and again in the form of drawings we just saw made by this obsolete machine. Those seem to be two things, the first a natural phenomena and the other a cultural artifact that went from multiplicity to scarcity, kind of survived the process of forgetting and became memorable. In fact, both seem to be animated by one another in your work. I mean, the only thing that enables the bird's appearance, right, or their presence or reappearance in the present is the recording, the playback, decoding of their voices. And in turn, it seems that the reappearance of the phonautograph, its reuse, its reactivation by you, is made possible by these echoes of past life. Can you tell us more about the reason for choosing to work with these materials and for the way that you chose to work with them?
I mean, there's very, you know, very different ways you can look at obsolescence and extinction. Obsolescence rings very true to me, and you know, from a very personal micro level to a macro level, you can relate to it both on an experiential level and then when you look around you. Extinction is obviously much more fraught and invested with meaning, and you know, like Jonathan was talking about this. So on the one hand, there's this proliferation of images and sounds, and the world is this kind of dump site / archaeological site where images and sound reproduction just lie one on top of each other. And I have the impulse to try and be able to look at things, you know, to be able to see things that in time have become invisible or marginal. In a very broad and basic way, is kind of my approach to imagery, to visual life, and to cultural products, is to try to be able to see them again and really see them. And on the other hand, you know, the ecological, the more ecological side of it, you know, it's terrible and it's awful, and I was trying to not make something that doesn't really, that frames it in a way where you can engage with it and it doesn't get slammed shut by, you know, the terribleness and the awfulness of it, but actually opens up a space where you can engage in a very vivid way with these representations of animals and species that no longer exist. And these representations are very vivid and very, you know, they really resonated with me, and just, you know, kind of open a space for them to be able to act and have nuance and, you know, kind of flow some, you know, maybe, you know, poetics and aesthetics through it. So it brings it back into a public sphere or, you know, or a viewer's space in a way that it's not about, you know, a lesson to be learned, but just something to be engaged with.
We're almost out of time, right? I have one more question for each of you. Is that okay with everyone? So first I wanted to play for you one of the commercials for Edison's phonograph. First, sorry for the change of plans. It was played in stores.
I am the Edison phonograph, created by the great wizard of the New World to delight those who would ask melody or be amused. I can sing you tender songs of love. I can give you merry tales and joyous laughter. I can transport you to the realms of music. I can call you to join in the rhythmic dance. I can lull the babe to sweet repose, or waken in the aged heart soft memories of youthful days. No matter what may be your mood, I am always ready to entertain you. When your day's work is done, I can bring the theater or the opera to your home. I can give you grand opera, comic opera, or vaudeville. I can give you sacred or popular music, dance, orchestra, or instrumental music. I can render solos, duets, trios, quartets. I can aid in entertaining your guests. When your wife is worried after the cares of the day and the children are boisterous, I can rest the one and quiet the other. I never get tired, and you will never tire of me, for I always have something new to offer. I give pleasure to all, young.
Allow me to make a sort of move here, which might be a little bit illegal, but I think there's an interesting link between how we perceive this self-attesting automaton and the way you, Jonathan, described the work of a contemporary historian in one of your essays, and I quote, "History deals in fragments, with traces, and whereas the fundamental condition for the ethnographer is some kind of co-presence, the fundamental condition for the historian is absence. We make use of the traces left behind, interpreting them, imposing our own frameworks and questions, and making them speak to our present." Can you tell us a little bit about how you relate to this animistic, if I may say, approach to history and to sound recordings in particular?
Well, we'll start with sound recordings. There is a... There's a thing that happens with sound recordings. It's probably no different from photographs, which is the indexicality they have is sort of overwhelming. You know, the sort of, oh my God, I'm hearing into the past. right? So my first reaction upon listening to that recording is like, wow, what a wacky declaiming style, you know, which was probably quite conventional for the period, and sort of to treat it as evidence of a past moment. But it isn't just evidence. For one thing, that particular recording was heavily cleaned up. So the relationship between the voice and the surface noise, totally different than if you were to actually play it back on a cylinder. We have wonderful digital tools to do this today. But metaphorically, that's sort of what happens in the writing and reconstruction of history, right? You take these raw materials, which are themselves sort of separated from their point of initial radiation or context, and you put them back together. You dress them up in different clothes. You reshape them and reimagine them. And so, I mean, it's, you know, it depends on what kind of past you want to write about. You know, there's a whole tradition of history from below that's about recovering lost voices and lost experiences from different moments in history of, you know, peoples who aren't particularly well archived or well represented in the history books. But I write about elites. And so me recovering the experience of Alexander Graham Bell, which would be otherwise lost to history, is kind of a ridiculous proposition. And so I'm less interested in sort of trying to describe the past in its fullness or give the flavor of past experience than, and I think this is especially important for communication technology, sort of holding those moments in dynamic tension with what's going on in the present, and thinking the history of communication technology relationally and trying to draw lines and make connections and make sense of things.
And one last question for you, sorry. So like other technological mechanisms such as photography, and you started to talk about this connection, sound reproduction had its own ghostly connotation, in the 19th century. Here we have an example of spirit photography. I know that at some point at this period, there was a growing fear of photography actually peeling off layers from the body, the subject's body, when she or him was photographed. And of course, there was an entire practice called spirit photography in Europe and North America that was at one point appropriated by the spiritualist movement, basing their claims on the perception of photography as an indexical mechanism, meaning faithfully recording or writing reality. So I wanted to ask you, Sari, do you find this haunted or ghostly discourse or methodology relevant to your work at all?
Well, first I would say that, you know, one of the things that I found fascinating about the phonoautograph is to me it had these really interesting connections to early photography, mostly in the materiality, the engagement with the process in the material, which later on disappears from photography, you know, as we know it. You know, I'm not talking even digital, but, you know, you shot a photograph and you sent it to the lab and it came back in an envelope. And in the beginning, it was this really invested, very, you know, oriented in the hands and experimentation. And it was, you know, very, it was very much in the material and the process. And when I learned about the phonograph and then worked with the phonoautograph, it felt very similar. It had these parallels that were very striking to me. In that, you know, in that way of engaging with the material directly and all the things that happen in the process. I think early, you know, photography, ghost photography and photography as proof of another life is kind of an interesting, it's kind of, you know, the interesting, it's a seamy, like, underbelly of where magic meets science, because the whole use of mirrors and chemical processes were shared by science and magic, and therefore science had a very ambivalent relationship to it, because it kind of tarnished and tainted their name because of these associations. Mm-hmm. So I can't say, you know, per se, I mean, the images are amazing. I can't say per se that they, you know, that this is what, you know, the images themselves are amazing, but it's because they rely so much on the the complicity of the audience to believe, you know, the need of the audience to believe that whatever's there is a ghost, is a testimonial to the afterlife, is, you know, your father on the other side. And with that, it's the complicity to believe that photography, you know, is indexically accurate, when clearly you see from the beginning of photography that it is, you know, highly manipulated, and no one who is a practitioner would ever say any different among themselves that, you know, exposure, retouching, a lot of other things that come into the making of a viable image are so controlled by the person that makes them. So I, you know, the fact it being indexical is, I think, is kind of is an illusion. It's an illusion we all are, you know, happily embrace and want to, you know, believe in. And the beauty for me in this process, I mean, what I'm interested in the act of translation is moving from one medium, processing through this machine, moving into another, and what happens, the mutations that happen, but, you know, how the process augments, you know, the image, you know, turns it into an image, and what is involved in that. And the fact that the machine is a very neutral, unsentimental, you know, unlike these you know, haunted, you know, photographs or these proofs of a ghost life. This machine has something very dry about it. It's almost this transaction that is very dry and neutral, and yet it managed to produce these very resonant images to me. And that, you know, that was kind of a surprise, and that was kind of where I found that that's where truth lies for me, in you know, truth in a way. Yeah. Or interest lies right in that process over there, where something is completely where there's an disinterestedness that generates this result.
Have anything to add? Questions?
Yeah, I've got one now. In your work, in a way, you try to preserve for you.
Let me get that. Is it turned up?
I'll stand up and talk. It's good. You can talk. So in a way, in your work, you're fighting a lost battle in order to preserve and document something that's already been lost for the ones who exist right now. I wanted to ask you guys, what's your perspective about noise these days, which is the opposite phenomena in our culture when it comes down to imagery, and sounds. You know, for example, I just got today in New York trying to call my friend, and her cell phone, she doesn't receive any incoming calls. You can't even text her. I send her a message on Facebook and she called me back. Or I can look at Instagram, where, you know, people uploading tons of photos in like ancient style, right, right. In order to,
the
this is
nostalgia.
Our present.
Yeah.
So what's your perspective about that or about noise?
Well, I don't have anything profound on cell phone reception, so I'll go with noise.
No, she's not receiving any calls. Like, you can't contact her. She blocked her phone.
Sounds liberating. So noise. It's a real hobby horse of both sound artists and sound theorists. Everybody's working with it. Everybody's dealing with it. It's like one of the sort of central tropes or terms or obsessions of thought in 20th century thought and communication. And I think part of that is because of the many different ways it's been defined, right? It's resistance, it's radical, it's chaos, it's the thing that breaks down the signal, it is the thing that reduces intelligibility or sensibility, or it is, you know, and that can be like a problem, like when you're trying to have a phone call and be heard at the other end, or it can be awesome when it's the thing that's this sort of the source of this radical experience in in an artwork or even in a piece of music. But for me, noise actually becomes, I mean, it's a defining aspect of the 20th century landscape. And so for me to see it on its, to accept the sort of terms that were given, that it is this form of alterity, that's the point that I've been sort of pushing against and trying to reject and think about ways in which noise has been domesticated, everything from the use of distortion in electronic instruments and electrical instruments of all sorts, to the use of muzak in public spaces, background noise, waterfalls in like corporate offices, producing different kinds of sort of sonic and spatial effects. And so for me, the question I ask now is sort of, well, what does it mean to normalize noise as opposed to treat it as this sort of agent of challenge or chaos? And so it makes me suspicious, for instance, of the noise reduction in the recording we heard at the end. I want the surface noise, because to me that's part of the story of the life story even of that I am a phonograph recording.
I think it's, you know, it's a material like any other, and it could have really wonderful manifestations like a John Cage recording where you just think, you know, it's just noise. Why does it sound so good? And something about the way that he touches that noise just makes it into this very compelling and intriguing, you know, piece of sound, package of sound. And I don't know what it is that he does, but it's something about the way, you know, he collected it. And on the other hand, you know, there's endless examples of, you know, of noise awfulness. And and for your friend, I very much relate to, you know, it erodes so many aspects of your life to have this like inundation of just incomingness all the time. But it's very hard to fight. So whatever she's doing, I think is a good idea in a way.
I just wanted to ask, sorry, about the sort of artistic result of the drawings and where you're going with that. And I wanted to ask you to talk more, if you would, about the metaphors that you're playing with, because it seems to me that the basic gesture of taking the extinct bird and playing that sound and then quote-unquote recording it through this this methodology that creates this physical line is, to me, it seems to be less about the idea of what we're losing in terms of the natural environment, and maybe something more about a kind of cultural loss. It reminds me a lot of the idea of languages that are preserved in writing, but that we have lost the ability to pronounce them, like even Native American languages like Algonquin, which have many, some of which have oral preservation today in terms of people speaking the language, and then many others of them which no one knows how to pronounce them anymore. So it seems to me ultimately about, it feels to me, from a visual perceptive level, to be about loss, about this kind of just impossible loss. And so I was just wondering if you could speak about what you think about that.
Yeah, it very much is. I mean, I'll answer your first question. This is going to be, you know, I imagine this as a sound and print installation. So I've been kind of playing around with this idea for the last couple of years of the filmless film. So taking, at first in my videos, I kind of took the moving image apart and recobbled it again together. That's, you know, taking color apart, taking even movement out and putting it back together in a very evident way. And the main part of it was taking the sound and the image apart and recobbling them together so they have they have a very active relationship where they really have to negotiate with each other to create some sort of, you know, from moment to moment coherence. Then I, you know, start to think about these filmless films where sound and other mediums have a relationship to each other and how they negotiate that and, you know, how different parts of the work negotiate that. And this, in a way, is a continuation of that, where it's a sound and print installation, and there's a soundtrack that relates to these images, which ultimately will will be a series of large prints, and I am in process of making. It's just for various, you know, practical and process reasons, not just from today to tomorrow, as we all know. And nestled within that is within this film is also that the sound and the image are, you know, two versions of the same thing. And it's that act of translation which I want to bring into the relationship on top of them coexisting within one space and kind of skirting this idea of creating a coherent image within a room that all evolves from the moving image, the film, the video, basically. The crudeness of it is something that appeals to me, is, you know, how do you make a filmless film or a moving image? There's something that to me makes a lot of sense about showing the seams, you know, something very very crude and dumb about putting things together and like, will they stick? Maybe it will fail, that, you know, potential failure. In terms of what you were saying about the loss, very much so. I mean, you want to talk about these things. You don't want to be too dramatic or sentimental on the one hand, and on the other hand, it's just part of any kind of movement on every level, ecological, technological, cultural, definitely linguistical. This was just a very purified, or, you know, it's a tincture of sorts where you could discuss loss in a way that was very economical, I felt, and somehow spare, somehow minimalist, so it doesn't get and not narrative, so it doesn't get too ornate or too didactic, or, you know, too, you always have to avoid the too, you know, when you want to make something that is going to be convincing and appealing and will be able to engross your audience and yourself, obviously, as the person who makes it. You know, something you can engage with for a while without it losing its potency.
Hi, I had a quick question for Jonathan, but it comes out of, your project, which in many ways to me, it reminds me of the idea, like, which just comes from Benjamin, that, you know, when a media is like extinct, that's when art begins to happen. And I wanted to ask Jonathan if you feel that that's still like tenable today with the speed at which media, you know, transitions or changes from one to the other.
What's interesting, I mean, because if you look at the art world today, right, at least if you look at funded work, you'd think exactly the opposite, right? That when a medium is new and perhaps doesn't really work, that's when art's going to get funded. It's sort of playing at both edges of it, in the sense of, and in so many creative cultures, there's an intense nostalgia for the equipment of the prior generation, jump back a few. But that's a really important driving force for creative people in all sorts of fields, and also for the new. And I actually think it's the same thing, right? In every case, you're going for some kind of break, you're going for some kind of outside, some kind of space from which to behold some aspect of banal everydayness, or, you know, something, I don't know, awesome and transcendent. In either case, you're going for something, a point of access to reality that isn't easily assimilated into common sense, into sort of everyday perception, but either forces you or others somewhere outside of it. So I certainly think the point is tenable. I certainly don't think it's necessary, but I think that one reason it's common to think in these terms is because it's such an apparent path outside, although it can also be deceptive, right? Because, I travel in the world of musicians, right? And sort of the obsession with analog synthesis, for instance, can be incredibly conservative as well, and bring you precisely back to the place you thought you didn't want to be.
Isn't the question more of the maybe questioning the production itself and not the object? I mean, as long as artists, musicians are going back to these mechanisms, but as long as there's some questioning of the actual production process, then there's an opening there for, you know, art or music to happen.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think...
because we focus on products all the time. And
yeah, I think yeah. Although I'm also not totally sold on the sort of process position either.
Right.
I mean, I think you're right that the sort of product... You like too much of that just is a sort of consumer model of art or something, but if you go all the way to the other process, and then it's like more about an experience for the artist than it is any kind of broader sort of cultural act. And so there's some kind of process is important, but it's part of something. I don't know what that thing is.
Hi. Sort of for either of you or both. I wanted to say, sorry, the connection to early photography was really interesting, especially the spirit photographs that you showed. I wanted to ask, isn't death also inscribed into recording technology as well? I'm thinking of these experiments by the Latvian writer Konstantin Radiv, who was trying to capture so-called electronic voltage phenomena, recording voices of the dead by miking graveyards and this kind of thing. I think Edison's early experiments were also interested in death and sort of he envisioned them as some kind of capturing of voices of the dead.
All right. Sorry, just negotiating in real time up here. Okay, so a few quick vignettes. First thing is, when you look at early announcements of the invention of sound recording, because it's, you know, Victorians and they're death obsessed. Like everything's, now we can preserve the voices of the dead, which is of course ridiculous in 1878, because you're talking about a machine that records onto tinfoil. You take the tinfoil off, you play it back too many times, you can't preserve the voices of the dead. So effectively, if you want to preserve the voices of the dead, you have to record the person, kill them, and then play it back. And then you have recorded the voices of the dead. So it's this really, the imagination's ahead of the technology. The sort of desire to preserve becomes a program for the development of recording devices and surfaces. And then this other thing about the sort of frequencies of the dead, my favorite example of this is in a Washington Post interview with Emil Berliner, who invented the gramophone, which is the flat disc version. It's more like what we would think of today as a record player. And somebody's interviewing Berliner about the sort of spiritual implications of sound recording and radio. And I forget what Berliner's answer is. But then the reporter writes, well, we know that soon we will be able to hear the dead because the only difference between the dead and the living is that the dead vibrate at a slower frequency. And of that, I am certain.
I think I have time for one. Oh, sorry.
I was just going to say that it is very interesting that early photography, especially in America, was intimately connected with the rituals of death and woven into those practices and rituals, and taking a photograph of a recently deceased person very quickly replaced any paintings or other image making of that. And it was a very broad use, it was very popular and broad use of photography, and photography served very well the culture in that way.
Time for one more question.
I just sort of wanted to ask a side note to that last question and ask if there is an industry built up around electronic voice phenomena in the way that there was around spiritualist photography, because that seemed to from my understanding, it seems like there's, you know, like everybody, you know, wants to go get their picture taken with a ghost, but the electronic voice phenomena seemed more like a scientific process. I just wonder if you could talk about that and their relationship to popular culture.
You knew it would be coming.
Yeah, I actually don't quite know how to get it. You know, I don't have a good answer to that. I guess I can try. I suppose the difference between spirit photography and electronic voice phenomena, at least in the contemporary version, you're talking about two completely different moments in the history of death, to begin with. My colleague John Durham Peters likes to say that between the end of the 19th century and the end of the 20th, sex and death basically switched in public consciousness. So where in the 19th century, sex was everywhere and taboo at the same time, death was like this matter-of-fact thing, whereas now, you know, as the device in the back of the room, the Oregon generator attests, sex is everywhere and spoken of frankly, and death is everywhere, but incredibly taboo. And so the relation people would have with those transmissions would necessarily be different because the context of reception and even what it means in terms of the possibility of hearing the dead would be different. So that's my shot. What's yours? Sorry.
I don't know. I defer to you on that one. I'll take the next one.
No. Well, okay. So first of all, that's one particular moment in the history of communication. At other moments, auditory versions of technologies precede visual ones. Certainly, you could say pretty much in the digital age, audio technologies almost invariably precede visual ones. So you would have to say that the primacy of the visual has been overturned in the 20th century, which is not really a proposition most visual culture theorists would be comfortable accepting. But I think that I think they're operating on different sort of historical conditions. The technical processes are quite different for photography and for sound recording. And for photography, you're talking about a chemical process. You're also talking about a different set of sort of epistemological and cultural formations. So for instance, and here I'm actually borrowing from my student and soon-to-be colleague Didier Delmas, who's writing a dissertation on the history of the possibility of photography, that it was much more caught up in discourses of, say, the relationship between subjectivity and objectivity, because those were the sort of philosophical obsessions of the time. So, I mean, I guess I'd read the inventions in relationship to the historical conjunctures in which they emerged, and less so as like sort of grand statements on the nature of hearing and seeing.
This note, we're
going to
wrap up. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.